This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Victoria's biggest teacher strike for 13 years is tomorrow. All 1,500 or so public schools across the state stand to be affected. How are you preparing and how do you feel about it? I'm Mary Guerin. This is The Conversation Hour. And the government says schools will be open, staffed by retired teachers and casual relief teachers. But depending on capacity, will that be possible? Do you know what's happening in your school? What's your school told you? And what are you thinking and feeling about it? Let me know. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. It's still unclear about how big an impact it will be across the state or between schools. We're going to try and get some details. The state government will just now be starting to get an idea because an hour ago was the deadline for principals to report back to the department about how many of their teachers plan to go on strike. So at the very least, by the end of the day, you should be hearing from your school as to whether your kid will have classes tomorrow, what the day will look like. Maybe your child has heard there's a strike and insists there's no way they'll be going, no matter what. This already from Liz, solidarity with the teachers. Our daughter's secondary school has said a modified Year 7 program, children of essential workers, years 8 to 12. I'm okay with that. Are you okay with what your school has told you? And of course, the strike comes after the Australian Education Union rejected the government offer of a 17% pay increase over 3 years. They're saying that only a 35% pay rise over 3 years will see them on par with their interstate counterparts. It's not just pay. They want reduced workloads and improved mental health support. Some principals are also joining in. They're the principals who are members of that union. Tell me what is happening at your school, what you're thinking about the strike, what you've heard, what your kid is saying, what arrangements you've had to make as well. Not everyone can have the luxury of choosing not to send your kid to school. So soon we'll be talking to the Principals Association about what strike day will look like. And as I say, it's not just about pay, it's about conditions as well. Teachers and principals say that the government is failing to acknowledge the increasingly complex nature of the roles. They're getting burnout. Do you have sympathy for that argument? You'll hear from one of the authors of a national study that's just been released in a timely fashion, saying a third of principals surveyed say systemic neglect is leading to burnout, resignation and moral injury. Do you agree? Is that what you've seen as well? Also this hour, a couple of questions for you. What makes a good airport? Avalon, as you've been hearing, is opening again for international flights, has had its first one today, meaning it can be considered in next year's global rankings of best airports. We're going to be speaking about what makes a good airport for you. Is it the food, the Wi-Fi? Maybe it's the toilets. Brings me to my second question. What makes a good public toilet? Yes, it's that time of year again. The great Dunny Hunt is on. Do you use the wonderful resource that is the National Public Toilet Map? What's the flashiest one you've been to? Did you know that there are heritage listed toilets? We will flush out that story later this hour. Let me know. 1300 222 774, the answers to any of those questions. Rebecca, you've called in from Coburg. What have you heard about tomorrow's strike?
Hi, Mary. Yeah, just called in. Our primary school is striking tomorrow, and all the messaging that we've received from Compass and emails from the school has been that if you need someone to like supervision for your child, that you'll receive it. However, when I spoke to the principal this morning, she was really pushing against having any kids come to school.
Why is that?
She's saying that there will only be three teachers at the school, three staff members at the school. There's usually around 50. And supervision is like not really an option, which I find a little tricky because my partner and I both self-employed. It just feels like at the moment in terms of like the state of the world, like it's a bit of a tone-deaf message for parents who are paying high interest rates and fuel prices. It's a really tricky time to be self-employed and trying to navigate all of those things.
Yeah. Rebecca, it's just a bit of a scratchy line, but thank you. I think there would be people who agree that it's going to be really tricky. Do you agree with Rebecca that it is also tone deaf?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
And it is coming up to 12 minutes past 11. Joining me now is Andrew Dalgleish, the president of the Victorian Principals Association. Thanks for your time, Andrew.
Thanks, Mary, and thank you so much for having me join you this morning.
Do we know what the impact's going to be tomorrow?
Look, Mary, the impact will be varied. I'm certainly aware that some schools have more people out on stop work action than others, and I really encourage parents to keep an eye out for that communication from their school. You know, look, principals, while respecting the right for industrial action, they understand the challenges, as your previous caller was saying, but they're trying to manage that real world impact on students and families as best as they can.
So we did hear from the Education Minister last week saying that schools will be open. There'll be retired teachers, casual teachers coming in. What are you hearing about how many schools might be able to stay open?
Look, I certainly don't have exact numbers around that. Mm-hmm. And we understand that in some cases there will be a requirement for suitably qualified region or central staff to be deployed into schools to support operations. And that's about making sure that there are safety actions in place. Students are supervised by appropriately qualified staff. Now, those schools that are impacted more heavily certainly may not have normal programs operating as would be expected.
But it's possible that some schools will not open, or that principals will ask people to keep their kids at home?
Well, look, the key point here is that schools are intending to be open. There will be plans in place and principals are managing this responsibly. I can't comment if there will be schools closed, because the intent is that all schools will be open as advised.
Mm. Andrew Dalgleish is the president of the Victorian Principals Association. We have heard, Andrew, that principals are going on strike tomorrow as well. Some are. What can you tell us about that?
Look, I certainly understand that some principals are exercising their right to take industrial action. And again, their responsibility there is in then ensuring that there is an appropriately qualified staff member who is in charge and can enact the programs within the school that will be available.
So those schools where the principal will be going on strike, there's the intention there also that the school will stay open?
The intention is that the school will stay open and that there must be, as part of normal regulatory requirements, a suitably qualified staff member that is in place and ensuring the safety of all students that are there.
Andrew Dalgleish, I'm going to be talking soon to one of the authors of a study that showed the extent of the strain that principals are under. In particular, the finding is that a third say systemic neglect is leading to burnout, resignation and moral injury. Does that surprise you?
Look, we certainly have been aware of these sorts of reports now for a number of years, Mary. And as a result of that, the department has, or the government has undertaken an independent review into workplace and admin requirements. But sometimes on this report, I think you're talking about, talks about some of the acts of violence and or aggression towards school leaders. And that continues to be incredibly concerning for us.
Andrew Dalgleish, thank you.
Thanks, Mary.
That's Andrew Dalgleish, the president of the Victorian Principals Association. Gavin says, Mary, the teachers probably deserve a pay rise, but is there any money in the kitty to pay for it? Helen says, support teachers all the way. They've been exploited way too much for way too long, underpaid, abused by entitled parents, and expected to be social workers for society's growing problems. Let me know what arrangements you are making about tomorrow, whether that's been difficult for you, what your school has told you.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Jane Wilkinson is the lead author of Hung Out to Dry. That's the report that's out today. And she's also the Professor of Educational Leadership in the Faculty of Education at Monash University. And she joins me now. Hello, Jane.
Hi there.
That's a very stark finding that is headlining your study. A third of surveyed principals saying systemic neglect is leading to burnout, resignation and moral injury. What's behind that?
Yeah, it's a great question. Look, there's a range of factors that are happening here, Mary. I think some of them are being alluded to by the teachers' strike tomorrow and that some principals are going to join. But certainly the excessive workload is a really major contribution to that. The other thing I'd say that principals really pick up on is that when there are critical incidents in their schools, a number of them are saying that they aren't being supported, that they don't feel like the system is actually reaching out to them and checking in to see how they are.
What's a critical incident in that context?
Yeah. So a critical incident, it would be something where that's out of the ordinary, if you like, in a school. So it might be a violent assault by a student on another student. It could be an assault against a teacher, for example. Those things that are very heightened that wouldn't be part of a typical day in a school.
You're listening to Jane Wilkinson, who is the lead author of Hung Out to Dry, talking about the pressure on principals. You point to the lack of employers' response in times of crises. Who's the employer in this sense then? Is that the government?
It's the departments of education across Australia. So, yes, it is the government. And this was a national survey. So we had principals reporting from across states and territories. This wasn't something that was confined to Victoria. And I think it's important to stress that principals also reported, you know, support from their employer. So it might have been from a manager or somebody in the system. But if a third of them are telling us that they felt that there was no support after a critical incident and or that they were actually, as one of them said, hung out to dry, that they were being held responsible when they felt that these things were actually not about their responsibility, but about broader conditions that are really creating issues in public education, then I think that is a worrying report and result.
So in other words, to give an example, it would be if there's a bullying incident, for instance, in a school that they don't feel supported enough, that bullying as an issue is addressed as in a macro way? I guess there'd be people listening who'd be saying, well, they have to take responsibility to some extent, don't they, as leaders?
Sure, absolutely. No, we're talking about major incidents. So an example might be a group of community members who gang up and seriously assault a teacher straight after work, after the bell, because they're annoyed about how a young member of their community has been treated.
Assaulted?
So,
physically assaulted?
Yes.
How often does that happen?
Common. Oh, it's very common. So our previous report reported on the levels of violence against staff and principals. And something like two-thirds of the critical incidents involved either actual physical violence or threats of violence and intimidation.
That is quite shocking. It's 20 minutes past 11. We're talking about the pressure on principals ahead of tomorrow's statewide strike, the biggest in Victoria for 13 years. That's teachers and some principals who are going on strike. Part of your survey, Jane, showed that there's a sharp decline in teachers who want to become principals. Where will principals come from if they don't come from teachers?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, one of the problems, of course, is that that's the important pipeline into the principalship is, you know, teachers who are excellent and who are aspiring to move into the principalship. And we really need to attract those teachers into the role, but we also need to be able to retain them. So I think there's two sides to this story. It's both about getting them in, but it's also about keeping them. And can I say that there's a really positive side to the complaint that teachers, principals are feeling hung out to dry? Doesn't sound positive, but in fact, research tells us that when principals feel really supported by their employer, when someone like a manager rings and checks in how they are, how they're going, and they show that genuine care, that makes an enormous difference, and principals feel that they want to continue. So there are some things, as Andrew Dalgleish mentioned, that Victoria, the Department of Education, is doing that I think are helping to support principals' mental health and wellbeing. But there's certainly a lot more that needs to be done.
Yes, you've highlighted there about the mental impact and so forth. There are many texts coming in highlighting that it's not just about the pay rise, and that is certainly true when it comes to the teachers as well. But for the moment, if we look at the pay rise, what is the role of a pay rise when it comes to that satisfaction as well, in your view, Jane Wilkinson?
I think it's about saying that we value you. You really matter, and your role really matters. I think one of the things that's quite disturbing in Victoria is that we have the lowest paid teachers across Australia. It's a bit of a Hunger Games at the moment, because if teachers are able to move to other jurisdictions where they can get paid better, then they may well do that. And so as a Victorian system, it's really important that we pay teachers and principals well, because we're saying to them, one, we value you and recognise the work you're doing, and two, it is a competitive system. So if we're not being well paid, then teachers and principals may be attracted, whether it's interstate or going into the non-government system, where they're potentially going to be much better paid. And we don't want to lose our wonderful principals and teachers. So it's really crucial.
Just as a final question, Jane, earlier I spoke to Rebecca, who's a mum trying to figure out what to do with her kid tomorrow. And, you know, she said, look, it's all very well, but in part what she said was it feels a bit tone deaf with everything that's happening in the world, that this strike is happening, that, you know, teachers are going for as big a margin, I guess, as they're going for in the pay rise. You've highlighted, you know, potential parity and lifting the boat, as it were, or lifting the water so all the boats rise. But what do you have to say about the timing of it?
Look, there's never a good time to have a strike. And I'm a former secondary teacher in Victoria myself and a deputy principal. And I know that teachers and principals agonise about taking stop work action. It's an absolute last resort, from my understanding, after something like 18 months of associations and unions negotiating in good faith with the department. So I do, as a parent of a former school-aged child, I really sympathise with parents. But I also would say, if we can take note of the bigger picture, that we want the best possible people teaching our most precious commodity, which is our children, and teachers and principals don't do this lightly. It really is a desperate last resort, I would suggest.
Jane Wilkinson, thank you for joining us. Jane Wilkinson is lead author of Hung Out to Dry. That's the survey that's been released today. She's from Monash University. Joining me now is Ben Sacco, a former deputy principal and education department staffer in Victoria, also the director of Education Economy. Hi, Ben. Thanks for joining me.
Hello, Mary. Not a problem.
What, from your point of view, you've escaped, but when looking back, what are the conditions like for teachers and principals in public schools?
Yeah, listening to some of your callers as well with their concerns, you know, it's growing admin requirements, increased expectations around data, reporting, and the behavioural complexities that our teachers and our principals are really trying to work with and grapple with in our schools today.
The pay rise is obviously, you know, a headline grabber as well. We know that the union has Among other things, rejected the offer of a 17% pay rise over 3 years. It says 35% will get them up to parity. Do you agree that that would be the number, or do you think that to achieve parity, the Victorian teachers could settle for something less? Where does the maths lie?
Yeah, look, I think the real question is what combination of pay and conditions actually stabilise and strengthen our workforce long term. And so we have these conversations every so many years. State-based pay is different. But I would actually suggest if we can, and this is what the AAU is trying to do, if we can look at even perhaps a national remuneration structure where we bring the state school sector to a level where it doesn't matter which state you're in. If you're a state school professional, there's a national remuneration that's fit for purpose and helps this be more sustainable long term.
Ben Sucko, in the long term, what do we really need to keep teachers in the profession and not burnt out?
Yeah. I mean, we want sustainable working conditions. And that's the common theme here. You've had people talk about excessive workload. I want to flag, actually, it's unproductive workload. And we should get the phrasing right and reflect the realities of the conditions our staff are being asked to work within.
How do you define that?
Yeah, too much of schools are basically asked to do a lot that serves systems rather than the students and the community. So, let's understand what's the work that needs to be done. Andrew mentioned, I think, or yourself, about a report that came out around admin tasks, a survey of principals that was released recently. There's some clear indications around work that can be reduced, that's seen as unproductive, and give back time to schools to do what they're there to do.
Ben Sucko, thank you for joining us in this conversation.
Anytime. Thanks, Mary.
That's Ben Sucko, who's the Director of Education Economy, a former Deputy Principal and Education Department staffer in Victoria. So many texts coming in on this. Helen says, why shouldn't they do it now? It's your caller who's tone deaf. Teachers have been shafted for decades and it needs to be fixed yesterday. Pamela agrees, saying this strike was planned and announced well prior to the Iranian problem. Also, teachers are not society's babysitters. And this on text, I'm taking the day off work to keep my kids at home in full support of striking teachers. They play such an important role in our society. And so many texts as well in support of the strike. Do you agree? 1300 222 774 is the number to call. We will get back to your calls and texts on this as everyone waits for word from their principal to see what is happening with the schools tomorrow. And I wish everyone luck in making those arrangements as well, and hope there is some clear communication. Tell me how yours is going. But next, we are also talking about what makes a great airport. Avalon Airport's resuming international flights today. Thank you for joining me on the Conversation Hour. What does make a great airport? Is it the food? Is it the comfy chairs? Is it some nice lighting? They used to be really bad, badly lit. Maybe it's the toilets, and we will talk about toilets as well a little later this hour. But joining me now to talk about what makes a great airport, Craig Platt, digital editor of Traveller at The Age. Thanks for joining me, Craig.
Yeah, no problem.
This is on the back of the world's best international airports ranked last week. Who won, and where were the Australian airports in this?
Yeah, so probably of little surprise to most people who have been through this airport, Singapore's Changi Airport came in at number one. It's the 14th time it's come in at number one. Interestingly, its chief rival, which is Doha in Qatar, which has also won a few times in recent years, withdrew from the awards at the last minute for obvious reasons. They basically have pulled out of any exhibitions or anything that they're doing. They've pulled out of airport events as a result of what's happening there, the fact that the airport's essentially closed at the moment. So in terms of Australian airports, though, Melbourne came in at number one. I won't say number one. It came in at number 20, and it was well ahead of the arrivals. Sydney was second among Australian airports, number 52. Sydney was at number 52. Mm-hmm. Brisbane was second at 40. And the other ones in the top 100 were Perth at 58, Adelaide at 72, and Gold Coast down at 81.
Do you agree, Craig, that Melbourne should have been the top-ranked Australian airport?
It's certainly a controversial view. I know we certainly got a bit of feedback from readers saying that they did not agree.
On what grounds?
Well, just that it's, you know, there's long queues, there's all these sort of issues that airports have. But look, I personally, you know, I live in Melbourne, but I do think Melbourne's probably better than the other airports. One of the big criticisms is Melbourne doesn't have a train, obviously.
Exactly.
I think when you're talking about the actual experience within the airport, I think it's pretty good. I think one of the best things about it is you can walk from one terminal to another. You know, if you need to go from domestic to international, it's a 5-minute walk. Whereas in Sydney, you've got to take a train or you've got to take a bus. In Perth, it can be difficult to get between terminals. I'm a big fan of that. When I've had a good run at Melbourne Airport, my record, and I have timed it, is from leaving the door of the plane to getting through immigration and customs and getting to the queue for a ride home, I've done that in 7 minutes.
Whoa! And did you run?
I didn't. I've managed that twice, and I think the only way I can ever beat that record now is to run. now, I should point out, obviously, I did not have checked baggage on that trip, so I didn't have to wait around for my baggage. But it's possible. I actually was chatting to the guy next to me on the last time I did it, who was an American from Texas, and the Americans can use our smart gates as well. And I said, "All right, stick with me when we get there. I'll take you to, you know, the right queue and the right spot to get your ticket to go through the smart gate." And he was out just as much time as I was.
That is impressive. I must admit I've never had the wherewithal at that stage of an international flight to time myself, but I need to do that now. Stuart says a good airport needs good signage, easy movement between domestic and international. Yes, I think that's what you were saying, Craig, too. In this context, I'm a travel writer who hates airports. My fave airport is Koh Samui because it's like a holiday, all fresh air and tropical juices. What do you think, Craig? You had the same experience?
Yeah. Look, I haven't been to Koh Samui Airport, but I have been to Krabi Airport in Thailand, and I found it a little bit too relaxed, perhaps. There was no kind of ropes to guide the queue for customs, and it was just complete chaos. So they only had one gate open. Nobody knew where they were supposed to be standing. Everyone was late for their flights. All the flights were being delayed. So my experience in the Thai islands and beaches of their airports is not so relaxing.
Yes, doesn't sound so. Rachel says a doctor on site at the airport would be good. My granddaughter fell and had suspected concussion last week. Eventually an ambulance arrived and paramedics sent her to hospital. It's concerning no doctor is available. There must be heart attacks and other emergencies all the time, says Rachel. That's very concerning. I hope your granddaughter is well, Rachel. Craig, is that true? There are no air. What's the situation for emergency? I assume there would be emergency trained staff at the very least.
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, there can be emergencies involving aircraft. I mean, I'm not really sure exactly what training there is, but I can tell you Changi has a doctor's office there that you
Changi
can go to.
Changi wins again.
Yep, if you're feeling, and you know, that's just sort of a GP office, but they've got one there. So if you are feeling unwell, you can pay them a visit. But yeah, I think generally speaking, you're just going to be reliant on the regular emergency services. But obviously, there are fire crews and things like that based at the airport, so they're going to have pretty good training on that type of stuff as well, I'd imagine.
Indeed. Craig, before I let you go, the news of the day is that Avalon's resuming international flights with Jetstar operating a regular service to Bali from today. Look, it's great news for travellers, I guess, but isn't this terrible timing when it comes to opening? I'm sure it was a long time on the books, but what do you make of the timing and what that means for Avalon, for all of us?
Well, I think when an airline launches a new route like this, it's a huge amount of planning goes into it. It takes a long time to get it. So It's a bit like the number of new hotels that opened in Melbourne during COVID. They were being built, they were finished, they needed to open. So they've launched, but you know, the flights are to Bali, so they're not going through the Middle East, they're going to Bali. I think they've got pretty good deals, which are probably going to be hard to come by for a lot of flights in the current environment with fuel prices. So look, I think launching flights to Bali is probably not a bad thing right now. And coincidentally, the last kind of international airline to fly out of Avalon, who didn't do it for too long, but that was Air Asia, they've just relaunched flights between Melbourne and Bali as well from the main routes, Melbourne airport.
The routes might be okay, but the prices, what do you believe will happen with the prices?
Look, prices are going to be up particularly to Europe, because you're losing that competition that the Middle East airlines previously gave all the other carriers that would go through Asia.
And the fuel?
And the fuel is the big one. So, I mean, Jetstar's launching with some sale fares. So, you know, if you're thinking about a trip to Bali and Avalon's convenient for you, it's probably a good time to get on board with that, because prices are probably only going to go up. And as we know, which happens with petrol and everything else, when they go up, they take a long time to come down. Again, even if the flow starts coming. So, yeah.
Yes, either go very soon or plan it for a bit later, maybe. Craig Platt, thank you so much for your time.
No worries.
Craig Platt is digital editor of Traveller at the Age. We were talking about what makes a great airport. Also, later in the hour, we are going to be talking about what makes a great public toilet. And Anna has drawn it both together, saying, I can't believe the terrible state of the toilets at Melbourne Airport. We've travelled at various times and have found the toilets in a bad state. It's frankly embarrassing that a reasonable standard can't be maintained when busier airports in Japan, Hong Kong, Singapore are pristine. Keep those texts coming in, 0437 774 774. I'll get to more of them and your calls about the Great Dunny Hunt. You know, there is that fantastic resource, which is the National Public Toilet Map. Do you use it? I want to hear about the flashiest toilets you've been to. Changing gears a little bit, there was another study out today, a really big one, that suggests that almost half of Australians think that the foreign military will attack our shores within 5 years. Does that include you?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
The Australian National University conducted a big study that suggests that we are very afraid, a lot of us, and particularly young people, about our national security. Joining me now is Rory Medcalf, who is a professor and head of the National Security College at the ANU and is behind the study. Thanks for joining us, Rory.
Good to be with you, Mary.
I was really impressed by the breadth of this study in terms of the number of years and the number of participants. Can you give people an idea of how this study has been formulated?
Sure. So look, my team at the National Security College have been of the view for a while now that the policy making going on in government on national security and defence and national resilience, while a lot of good work's being done, it's not connected enough to the public debate and to what the community thinks. And we're in a fast-changing world, a very diverse population in Australia. We felt it was important to have a much finer-tuned understanding of community attitudes and to encourage more of a national conversation on these issues. So over the past 15 months, we've surveyed more than 20,000 people, three waves of surveys by the Social Research Centre, which is a very reputable outfit in that capacity. We've had more than 480 interviews around the country. We've conducted focus groups. We've invited submissions from the public, and we've distilled all this information to put together three reports that are out today that paint a picture, sure, of anxiety. I'd rather not use the word fear, but mm-hmm. It's concern for sure, but also I think shows an appetite for a national conversation.
Indeed, it seems like an interesting way to frame anxiety or fear. And as I say, we don't want to be scaremongers here, but how did you phrase it? Was it about just anxiety? Is it how worried are you? Did people have to rate their anxiety?
So the report, the main report is actually called No Worries with a question mark, because I think, you know, in Australia, we like to think we don't have worries. The whole idea of security, which literally means without care, is a state of mind where you can engage confidently with your worries. So the questions we asked were not about naming names. We didn't name countries. We didn't name ideologies. We didn't name enemies, real or imagined. But we did focus on what do you want to protect as Australians? So things like safe and peaceful communities, prosperity, resilience, democracy, and so on. And then we provided a list of about 15 risks or threats and asked people to rate those in terms of how seriously concerned were they. So it was words like concern or worry about these as threats to Australia, and how likely they saw these risks were to become real, what would be the consequences if the risk were to happen, and finally, how prepared is the nation for each of these problems. And that's how we formed a pretty fine matrix of what the community thinks at this point in time.
You're listening to Professor Rory Medcalf from the ANU about some findings released today. This jumped out at me, Rory. 3 in 5 Australians are now worried about national security, with the sharpest increase among 18 to 24-year-olds. Within that age group, 55% said they worry about national security. That's up from 22% in 2024. That's an extraordinary jump. And would you assume that the number might even be higher, you know, in March 2026?
Look, it is an extraordinary jump. And at one level, you know, I think my research team and I fully understand that particularly younger Australians and Australians on lower incomes or people who are facing a whole range of other challenges in life are not going to fixate on national security as their primary concern. They're focused on, you know, their economic hardship or the opportunities in life. They might be focused on climate change, which in our report, of course, we did define the impacts of climate change as being a security issue. But having said that, over those 15 months since we began the study, and incidentally that marked the beginning of this second Donald Trump administration, mm-hmm. That was coincidental, but I think that's a really important marker.
You don't think it played a part?
Well, clearly it did. And I think it was just coincidental that we chose that timing. I think if we cannot track with fidelity what were the causes of which rise in anxiety over the past 15 months. And there's other research to be done on that. But we did do focus groups where we talked with people about what motivates them, what animates them. And issues like the failure of the international rules-based order, we had a question in there most recently about a world where strong states do what they want because there are no rules, that had more than 70% seriousness rating among the public. In other words, people are highly concerned about that. The impacts of wars, Ukraine, the Middle East, Gaza on Australia, the Bondi terrorist attack, very clearly that atrocity did register because the rise in concern among young people was very sharp on terrorism. Middle of last year, young Australians on balance were generally not all that worried about terrorism, and now they are. So all of these things have converged. You know, I would say at a military level, the fact that the Chinese Navy did a lap of Australia last year may have played a part, but we can't track that specifically. I think the main issue now is that if we were to take a new set of surveys, because we did conclude our surveys at the beginning of February before the current conflict in the Middle East or before the current US-Israeli war against Iran, it's quite likely we would see even higher figures of concern across the community, including about national preparedness, supply chains and so forth. But it's important to recognise that a lot of the concerns we identified in the middle of last year or even late 2024 were about things like threats to supply chains, threats to infrastructure, threats to the continuity of normal life from shocks overseas. So I think that reflects common sense. It reflects that the public understands the connected way the world works. and is sending a message to government to say we want a more open conversation about how we prepare for whatever future shocks lie ahead, not out of fear, but in order to build greater national confidence.
Yes, another figure that did jump out at me is that even though it's the lowest on the list of events that the people surveyed considered was likely, was the onshore attack by a foreign military, but still 45% considered that that was either likely, very likely, or almost certain within half a decade. And that's when they were asked last July. What does government do with this information, Rory? Wayne has texted saying, it's not surprising people are concerned. The government doesn't listen to anyone about anything in this country. I mean, Wayne's cynical. But what would you have to say about the importance of this survey? What does a government say? Is it just a matter of reassuring people? Is it a matter of increasing, more different messaging when it comes to, for instance, defence spending in a budget?
So there's a lot of great questions wrapped up in that one. And I would say for the benefit of your listeners, you're dead right. There is a data point there of 45% of respondents across the population saying they think it's likely that there'll be foreign military attack within 5 years. And that was a striking, slightly shocking figure. Some people I briefed on this in the National Security Bureaucracy in Canberra said, well, yeah, sure, but that's the lowest likelihood of any of the threats being marked. And sure, that may be a slightly alarmist number. I suspect if government was assessing that likelihood, they would put a lower number on it. But the point is, the concern is there, and it doesn't necessarily mean invasion. I think it's really important to understand that we chose the word attack, not invasion. An attack could be, it could be the use of a single missile. It could even be some, I hate to use the terminology, but non-kinetic military action as well, military action that doesn't necessarily involve lethal force. But it's still a very disturbing figure. How does that track into the debate with government? Look, we also recognise that there are other priorities. A lot of people we spoke to, when they would unpack these numbers in our focus groups, would say, sure, I'm worried about this stuff, but I'm worried about cost of living, economic hardship, first and foremost. I don't have time to think about national security. And then they would go on to talk about national security. I think the takeout of this for government is a more open national conversation. I don't think it's simply changed messaging or more talking points. And it's not just reassurance. It's got to be reassurance with foundation. And I think that's where a lot of the elements are actually in place within the bureaucracy, within Parliament. But until this point, we haven't seen a really open dialogue with the community about risk management, about saying this is the range of issues we need to deal with as a country. This is how we propose to do it. This is how we propose to engage with the states, the territories, business, civil society, all those people who can play a role. And I think that moment will come.
Yeah. And just before I let you go, you did in passing talk about defining climate change as part of the national security threat. Is that also, we've talked a lot about defence and defence spending and invasions, but do you think that this, was there any messaging there for government to say that they aren't looking at climate change seriously enough when it comes to people's perceptions of those risks?
Well, I think the core issue here is continuity of normal life, if you can, however you define it, in Australia. And there are so many good things about living in Australia, whether it's, democratic systems and freedoms, or whether it's, relative physical safety, whether it's having communities dispersed around the country, that are reasonably secure. And there's a whole range of risks to all of that. Climate risk is one, natural disasters on a scale not seen before, however you see the cause of that, plus all of the other issues we've talked about here today. I think the message that came out of this report is that communities want security to be understood at a level that can engage with their normal lives. And that may mean that some of the preparedness against different types of shocks can be useful for other shocks. So, for example, communities that are more climate resilient are also communities that could cope with a temporary breakdown in supply chains, for example, or information shocks. Disinformation was a huge issue across this report. And this could be approached in an ethos of national confidence, not of national fear. So really, that's the purpose of this work. And we're going to convene a conference in Canberra for the next 2 days with about 400 delegates from around the country to talk about where do we go from here.
The focus on resilience, not anxiety. Professor Rory Medcalf, thank you for talking us through some pretty fascinating results.
My pleasure, Mary. Thank you.
That's Professor Rory Medcalf, head of the National Security College at the ANU.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Look, I know I've only been in the chair for a couple of weeks. I feel we know each other pretty well now. And I've got a bit of a personal question for you. When you plan a day out, how much do you think about what sort of access you might have to a dunny, whether it's a Sunday country drive, just a day exploring the city? Do you need to know where you can quickly go to? Does it weigh on your mind? Public toilet advocate and researcher, I love that title, Catherine Webber, is here to save your day. She's here to chat about the Great Dunny Hunt. Hello, Catherine.
Good morning, Mary.
For those not in the know, what is the Great Dunny Hunt?
So we're really fortunate in Australia that we've got the National Public Toilet Map, which people can download as an app on their phone or have a look on the website. Now, every year, the Dunny Hunt, we're asking people to add more toilets to this map. So it currently sits about 25,000, but we think there's more toilets out there that people need to find.
How do they not make the map? Is that because they're just not declared when they're built by governments?
Yeah, so this is a crowdsourced resource. So there isn't one owner of public toilets across the whole country. So it is up to the owner or to people to find them so we can add them onto the map.
It's up to all of us. Catherine Webber is talking about the Great Dunny Hunt. Catherine, we were talking before about there being heritage-listed dunnies. You've told us this. What makes a heritage-listed dunny?
Look, Melbourne has these beautiful bottle green cast iron, originally urinals, built from about 1903. So they're part of our public spaces, which is really beautiful, but also have a functional purpose as well.
They must be terrible to maintain, I would have thought.
Well, originally they weren't even connected to the sewers, so they would have been pretty gross to walk past. They have been updated since then, and some of them have been transferred into sit-down toilets for men and women. But, yeah, they originally started as urinals with no sewer access.
Catherine, how many toilets have you mapped already, did you say?
So on the map there is about 25,000 toilets, but we do think there's more out there.
And so do people, do you have a core group of people who like to map them out for you?
Well, I think there are people that are super passionate that when they're travelling will check the map and see if they can find one, or if you know there's one in your park, you can check it and see if it's on the app. But this call is open for everybody. We're asking everyone to have a look at the map and see if there's a toilet there that you, is missing. There's also an incentive. If people do participate and add new toilets, they can enter a competition to win a $1,000 voucher.
Oh, here we go.
Yes.
So how do they do this?
So first you have to go to either the website or the app. You do need to register or log on, and then you either add a new facility or you can update the details of a facility that's already there. So it could be including the opening hours, adding a photograph of what it looks like, and then you can enter the competition.
Catherine Webber, thank you so much and good luck with all of it. Just really briefly, it's for a good cause, is it not?
So we know that one in four Australians experience incontinence, but we all need to use public toilets, so it's helping everybody out there.
Catherine Webber, thank you for your time. If you're interested, and you can also always win that prize as well, there's the Great Dunny Hunt is there for you. Judy is saying she loves the toilets at the Sofitel with amazing views. Thank you for joining me in conversation. You can catch it again on the ABC Listen app.